the original colored charts that you made up, and you were just telling me about how exciting some of them.
Yes, when they actually occurred, with the pin that set up there, when I was waiting for long periods and nothing happening, and these things rose out of the on the A scan of the cathode ray tube, it was tremendous excitement, and whoever was observing would try and turn on the camera as quickly as possible and shout or scream to get the other one along to come and have a look what was going on.
Sometimes you did miss the beginning, though.
That's right. Invariably missed the beginning.
Yeah.
Except, of course, when we learned after a while that with type 3 bursts, that, which were very short, only lasted about 10 seconds, the beginning was very important. But we soon learned that they tended to come in groups, and so we'd keep the camera on for, and possibly if we missed part of the first, we'd get all of the second or the third.
Mm-hmm. Now this thing was absolutely unique at this time, right?
Mm.
In fact, is it true that the next one wasn't built until the mid or late 50s when Alan Maxwell's?
Right. The next one was really...
Well, you said your second one.
56. I spent... first part of 56 with Alan Maxwell.
I see.
At Harvard.
Well, okay, we'll talk about that just a bit later on. So you had no competition, essentially.
No competition.
But tell me now about these three types. You said that they were clear-cut as far as very little things, very few in between cases, or maybe none at all. What did you make of them? What did you think was going on?
Taking them in turn, well, not in the right order, but if you start with the type 2 bursts, there had been one example recorded on single frequencies by the crew. Trying to think, Payne's got Gabsley and Bolton.
There. Right, I think that's correct.
And this is one unique example in which there seemed to be a drift from, it's a very slow drift from high to low frequency. Payne Scott had followed these observations up and found no other cases, and she concluded it was an accident. But when that first one came, it was led to a letter to Nature. There was a suggestion, I think it came from Pawsey, that it was perhaps due to an outward moving disturbance at 1,000 kilometres a second, or 800 or something kilometres a second. And
the idea of different frequencies originating in different electron densities was pretty straightforward.
Not so straightforward. That really came out of the work, as far as we were concerned, of D.F. Martin, who had out of the Quiet Sun work at different mm-hmm. levels. And this was a piece of original work by Martin. It turned out in later years that at a similar time, Ginsberg in Soviet Union had come to the same conclusion, published it. Somewhat similar time.
Which you didn't have that translation?
No, it was, as far as we were concerned, it was a... we only knew of Martin's work. And, so, this, as we found that this was, in fact, a regularly occurring phenomenon, we found more and more evidence to favour that hypothesis. And of course the ultimate evidence really came with the Dapto work, when the harmonics came along, and it had to be a resonant frequency. And the plasma frequency was the only candidate. So that was the thing that nailed the plasma hypothesis, was the harmonics.
Yeah. Well, what could it have been before that? What else were you considering?
Well, there are various theories for frequency drift. One was a sort of a great big concentration somewhere in the solar atmosphere, if a concentration of electron density, of like a bubble that gradually burst, as it were, or a concentration which
spread itself.
When it came to type 3 bursts, we advanced the hypothesis of, not immediately, we mainly pointed out that, let me start again. There was a hypothesis by Jager and Westfold to explain the type 3 bursts, different time delays, as due to group retardation. And this is looked into in the third of my papers. Mm-hmm. Now, by a very systematic quantitative argument, we were able to show that this was wrong. This was completely incompatible from a very general
point of view.
And this was in the third paper.
Right, this is in the third paper.
The source cannot be fixed. What was the key part of that argument?
Key part of the argument was a rather subtle one. Virtually measures the curvature.
This graph,
figure 6,
right, depicts the curvature of the burst on the time frequency plane. And what is plotted here is the time interval of the upper frequent part of the frequency range versus the time interval on the lower part of the frequency range. So that a straight line burst, a linear burst, would fall on a 45 degree line. Now the Jager-Westfold hypothesis said that it had to fall in the shaded portion, and not one example in fact did. They fell up here. On the other hand, the whole thing was entirely consistent with the idea of a source which moved outwards at constant velocity, and we later, we didn't push this hypothesis, we merely said it was consistent with. Mm-hmm. Later on, further evidence came along at the adapter, and then we really pushed that hypothesis, said this looks like the real thing. It met very great opposition because no one had heard of any particles from the sun which with such high speed ejections of 1/3 of last week. I remember that I think at the first IAU conference I went to in Dublin in 1955, I can remember walking along with the great man Alfvén, mm-hmm, saying, "You're wrong, you know." And I said, "Well, let's have a bet." But I can't remember what the bet was.
Or if you ever collected. So people were willing to accept the slow drift, 500 kilometers a second,
right,
or something like,
yes,
that, but not the very high speeds.
Yes.
What was the question came to mind? When you were figuring out these velocities, were you just taking standard models of the electron density versus height?
Yes, indeed. By this time, there were fairly trustworthy models of the electron density of the solar corona. And due to the work of D.F. Martin, and also, we didn't know at the time, but in Russia, by Ginzburg, the notion of different frequencies coming from different levels, according to the plasma frequency, had emerged. And so this is how we got our velocities, by combining these two facets.
But the actual models that you used, were they smerges, perhaps, or?
What the actual models really were the models used by Steve Smurd as well. The model was really known as the Baumbach Allen model, which came from eclipse data. What Steve Smurd's big contribution was to work out the radiation from the quiet sun.
Okay, well, we've discussed type 3, the type 2 slow drift. You haven't mentioned anything about the correlation with flares. Could you tell me what sort of cooperation you had in these early days between optical and radio and so forth also?
Yes, well, the solar, international solar community is a very closely knit cooperative one. We didn't know very much about flares at that time. In fact, the flare as a solar phenomenon is almost entirely a post-war thing. If you look in early pre-war books, probably there was only one by Abetti, the flare hardly gets mentioned. Since the war, it's become the main phenomenon, really, on that scale. It's the main phenomenon of solar activity.
Why was it missed? Because people weren't looking at H-alpha, perhaps? Or?
I don't really know why it was missed. Probably because people weren't taking so many routine, frequent observations. That is, taking pictures every second of the images.
Yeah.
Or much less.
That's
there was a lot of prominence across recording, and baculi and poculi, or whatever they were.
But you're right, though. You, the expense of a monitoring program is, as a standard now,
yes,
would be very great then.
But it was a very early result, of course. The solar flare wasn't, or chromospheric eruption was known right from the very word go when they were first observed in the 19th century. The suspicion of their correlation with aurorae and magnetic storms emerged. And of course, what the type 2 burst has done is to establish almost beyond doubt that the type 2 burst is itself the agency which causes the aurorae and magnetic storms and links the flare with the burst phenomenon.
Right. Getting here a day or two.
Eventually we identified the phenomenon of the type 2 burst as a shock wave.
That comes a little bit later, though.
That comes a bit later.
Right. But now, what about the correlation with flares? Where were you getting your optical information from?
I can't remember. This is internationally available data.
So it was not any local optical astronomy.
Wasn't any.
It was just the standard reports of solar activity.
Yes. Yes.
For instance, I know that C.W. Allen took some interest.
C.W. Allen did indeed.
But perhaps but directly with you.
Yes, well, we had a lot to do with C.W. Allen. He himself made a very valuable series of single frequency observations, 200 megahertz observations and so on. And did a lot of good work in helping to classify the various types of phenomena that you could recognize on single frequency. But I don't think in those days Mount Stromlo was really did any solar work. There was a certain amount of work done at that time, observation of flares by Giovanelli's group and Murray McCabe. from the roof of the of our own laboratory that was then at the university. Mm-hmm. But there was a fair amount of optical flare. There was no problem in getting sufficient to
But you did not develop an actual collaborative program with them, that saying we'll be observing the next week. You know, will you guys really observe for the next week, or something like this?
Not really. They monitored the sun at that time, which is all we were asking for. Later on, when we were at Kalgoorlie, I think Giovanetti himself would have been quite interested to develop a program on flares, optical flares, and working closely with us, but his own collaborators were not interested in that sort of thing. There's never been a very close, apart from a social one, there's never been a very close sort of collaboration between the optical and the radio part.
Let me ask a more general question. Obviously you were becoming educated about the sun, and perhaps even astronomy more generally. Was this all just a matter of going to the library and reading books yourself, or the transformation from a radio physicist to an astronomer?
I think reading bits and pieces here, and going to astronomical meetings and talking to astronomers. Things just rubbed off. And but there was no systematic attempt, in my case at least, of self-education in astronomy.
Or were there ever, for instance, any series of lectures organized in the department?
In CSIRO?
Right, yeah. Where people would bone up on different areas and give lectures or something?
No, not really. There were the usual scientific colloquia people would give. I think people like Steve Smird occasionally would give some educational talks, but there was nothing systematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, along the same line, if in the early 50s someone asked you, what do you do, how did you answer them? How did you describe you?
I'd probably say I was a physicist. It would have been misleading and pretentious to have called myself an astronomer at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word radio astronomy came in just about 1950, 51 or something like that.
Now, you mentioned international meetings, or astronomical meetings. When, in fact, was the first time you went to an astronomical meeting?
I went to the Dublin one in 1955.
And there were no previous ones in Australia here?
Well, the biggest international event in Australia was the ERSI meeting was held in 1952.
52. I think it was, yeah.
And I think that was the first big international conference of the scientific unions of any kind held in Australia.
Did you present results at that meeting?
Yes, indeed. In fact, it was really the Penrith results that were presented.
Mm-hmm. And this probably afforded the first opportunity to meet some other people. Can you remember?
Well, yes, the leader of the chairman was Appleton at the time. And there are many others who are in that photograph.
Oh, that's right. In your
That is taken at the time of ERSI. And so that was
Mueller.
There's
Steinberg, Hagen.
Right. Doc Ewan.
Oh yes.
Henry Brown, who was from
that's
the UK.
Right, at that time, yeah.
Lafeneur, Monsieur Lafeneur,
right,
in France.
But now I'm wondering, did you profit at all from this interaction with them, or was it mainly...
Oh, very much. It was very exciting. First, it's a chance of meeting people from other countries, and it was very stimulating. And they came round, I remember at the time we'd just set up Dapto Field Station, and they all came to visit us, including Appleton in his grey striped trousers and everything, and he gave us very great encouragement and said all the right things.
Okay, going back to the Force paper now is the only one that we haven't discussed, I believe, and that has to do with the enhanced radiation, as you call it. Could you tell me?
Yes, or it's become, yes, the noise storms or type 1 storms. That is, continues really to be the hardest to interpret, but I'm rather out of touch with the subject in the last few years. I'm not sure what advances have been made, but it's believed to be due to radiation from probably plasma radiation from charged particles trapped in the strong magnetic fields of sunspots.
But what were you making of it at that time? That's
really very little from the spectrum. We didn't really want to speculate on things. We didn't get a real clue from the spectrum. But there were clues from the fact that they were very strongly correlated with sunspots,
mm-hmm.
especially large sunspots. That was a result really that Ruby Payne-Scott brought out. So they had to do, certainly it seemed to associated with very strong magnetic fields. But we got nowhere at that time in interpreting.
And you did mention measure some circular polarization also.
Yes, although that had been established before.
Also, you mentioned a minimum in the spectrum at 89 megahertz.
Yes, that turned out to be a chance thing. The point is that I think we did have a caveat when we described this, that we said the chances of this happening by chance, if everything were independent, all the bursts were independent, is something very low indeed, but in actual fact they're not independent. They were all taken from about 4 storms, so the number was really 4 and not several hundred.
I see.
Small number statistics. That would have been intensely interesting, but of course it didn't. Eventually. And about this time I did get very interested in, since hydrogen was the main ingredient in the sun's atmosphere, I got very interested in spectrum of hydrogen and when the hydrogen line was discovered, I got an internal report that I'd written on the hydrogen spectrum and dusted it and edited it and published it in the Astrophysical Journal. This, in fact, is one of the earliest papers on this.
Right. That was, in fact, my next question here.
I was very stimulated by the possibility of lines, spectral lines, in the solar spectrum.
Which, so that was your real motivation?
That was the motivation. Yeah. And
you did conclude that perhaps this 3-centimeter line could be visible.
Hmm. Yes. And, well, it's still on the cards.
People have tried.
Yes.
Did you ever try at that time?
No.
And also, you recalculated the Einstein A for the 21 centimeter line, which had been incorrect up to that point. I think Purcell.
I don't think I calculated it. No, I think this was Purcell. I don't think I take it.
Well, you say private communication from him.
Yes. Yes.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about that was the recombination lines are dismissed in a...
In one sentence.
Right.
Yes, that's one of the most famous sentences I've written.
Sorry to bring it up.
People reminded me of that many times. But,
did you...
But I think it's still a perfectly valid statement that they were just undetectable from the kind of equipment that could be dreamt of at that time.
But I believe what you said then was that they would be blended together.
Right. Or blended together or with, or be indistinguishable from the background.
Yes, a continuous spectrum.
And...
no, I was just wondering, was that based mainly on the result that Vanderhulst had in his famous paper in Dutch, which I guess you had a translation of? When you wrote this, is that true that you had a translation of that? Or
no, I think I don't know that we ever managed to get a translation of Vanderhulst's paper. Very elusive journal, wasn't it?
Yes, right. So you were...
My interests were originally in not the recombination lines, but the fine structure lines. I suppose recombination lines are... But no, let's think. Recombination lines are different main quantum numbers, aren't they?
Right.
Yes, yes, my main interest was in the fine structure lines. But that sentence was tossed off with a minimum of thought.
Okay. Well, that makes sense if you didn't see Vanderhulst's paper, because he actually did consider recombination lines in that paper.
Yes.
And came very close to getting it quote-unquote right, but he made a slight mistake in the line broadening calculation and concluded that they would not be detectable.
I see.
Whereas if he'd done that right, even with the knowledge that was available then, he might have said at high frequencies you could get a few percent line to continuum ratio.
Yes.
But if you didn't even see that article, now did you have a translation of the Shlosky article? 48, you refer to that?
I can't remember. I probably we had it in there.
Now there I can check the date of the translation for the division here. That was
yes.
Tell you what it is. Yes. There. So anyway, your main motivation for doing this paper, which is primarily known for its 21 centimeter work, was more to do with solar applications.
Right, that's what got me interested to start with. And some of the, I got some extent interested in lines due to some instrumental effects in spectrograph due to mismatches. Certain frequencies showed up better than others due to mismatches. Well, I
see.
Until I recognized that they were due to mismatches, I got interested in studying the spectrograms.
You thought they might be real. I see. That's interesting. I don't think you mentioned that in the paper, that was part of why you were...
Well, I didn't mention the motivation. I don't think one usually does.
Well, you're right, but I would like to put a note in that one should.
Yes.
Certainly from a historical point of view, it also makes for more interesting reading. But let's move on. In the volume edited by Kerper on the Sun, you put a chapter in on solar radio techniques, and you also had a review article on radio astronomy as a whole and the advances in electronics and electronic physics, I guess it was. So obviously your work was becoming known and you were writing review articles. In terms of observational radio astronomy, when you wrote that article in 1954, you obviously had to make an assessment of the whole field. Can you put yourself in that time and sort of comment on how you saw the field as a whole?
Well, I think that by that time, the radio physics laboratory was so imbued with radio astronomy that... And that at that time one tended to keep track of the whole subject, which nowadays is very much harder. And one was in touch with, in Australia, with a lot of people working in the various different branches, and also again at international meetings. So it was good education on my part to write that article. It sort of made one sit down and read a lot of literature. Make an assessment of things. But I've tried to keep it with a touch of individuality. I even put up a rather crazy type of radio telescope.
What do you mean, put it up?
I described an original type of radio telescope, which was a sort of an early version of an aperture synthesis. It required four elements.
I see, I didn't remember that.
Okay.
Can you just tell me now what...
Here we are, the possibility of photographing radio brightness distribution.
Aha.
So it was a sort of, a little bit of a...
So it's a bit of a precursor, we might say.
Precursor, yeah. Yes. This is the sort of thing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So you worked out the...
It was really...
Fourier theory of it.
Well, it was really... See, the Mills Cross had come along at that time, and this was simulating a Mills Cross with the aid of four elements which were movable. Well, eventually, in the final form of aperture synthesis, of course, simpler than all that, you only need two elements. But what I'm saying is that I didn't want to merely write a review article without a certain amount of original thought.
And you state here, the outstanding technical problem of radio astronomy today is to improve the resolution, basically. Clearly what was on your mind, and I actually have a note here now, I see that already you were thinking about image formation.
Right.
So, I guess it would be fair to say that this is really the first sort of thoughts that were eventually to lead you to Kalgoorlie. Is that correct?
Yes. And of course, when we were surrounded by people working in this field, Mills and Christensen.
Although you hadn't at that stage discovered the rapidly moving sources, I don't think, is that?
Well, I think, yes, I would have got the spectrum by then. I mean, it would have, but not.
But you didn't have the interferometer yet.
Not the interferometer.
Yeah, yeah. But you probably suspected that there might be.
I've forgotten what date that was written.
It was 55, it was published, so probably 54.
Well. Right, the interferometry came fairly soon after, well, a couple of years or so.
Okay, let's move on to the work now with the second spectrograph. Can you tell me, you've already mentioned that you decided you need a properly engineered thing, so to speak, and what were the new characteristics you wanted to have in this second spectrograph?
The most important thing was broad band, much broader band. And we were aiming for something like an 8-to-1 band, done in three lots of 2-to-1. And this proved to be a very important thing because it immediately paid off dividends in producing the harmonics,
right,
which we couldn't have got really before. The other thing is polarization, more sensitivity, and circular polarization.
Did you want to be able to look at bursts in different single polarizations, or were you able to measure the polarization during a burst, or how did you?
We tended to. Strive strangely enough, I can't think that we did it. I think we recorded the two side by side, left and right hand polarization. But that was one way of recording, another was to do it in sort of time sharing. We also introduced the more convenient type of display of the intensity modulated displays, which was much more automatic, much more economical. But one was deprived of the quantitative intensity detail, which was just rather sacrificed. So I don't think there have been any such detailed observations in intensity to compare with the Penrith one.
Is that right?
No doubt nowadays with sophisticated photometers and things you could probably
extract. You could do it, but no one... Do I remember correctly John Murray telling me that you did have a rough intensity scale that you put on the film also?
Right, yes, that's a routine calibration, right. Just to give a sort of order of magnitude. But it seemed at that time that the early observations had shown a lot of interesting things about the intensity characteristics, but one was looking for more broader characteristics and didn't need that detailed intensity profile.
Well, and like you say, it immediately paid off in terms of finding this harmonic structure, which you publish in a Nature note. That reminded me, I wanted to ask you, why did you not send off a note to Nature about the types 1, 2, and 3? It seemed to be the style around the laboratory, didn't it? And that certainly was a very interesting result.
It sort of emerged very gradually. It was quite a low-key thing to begin with. And I think it was only at an IAU meeting. I forget when that was, 1952, I think, but...
In Rome?
In Rome, I think, yes. I wasn't there, but I think Bolton and Pawsey were there, and it caused a great deal of interest. And it was only then that one realised that perhaps there was something interesting in it.
I see.
And the nearest thing to a letter to Nature, I think, was Bracewell was in England at the time, and he gave a little account of it as he used to at the Astronomical Society, and that did actually appear in the Observatory.
I see.
And Bracewell did a number of things like that.
So that's interesting. So identifications of radio sources or some of these other things were looked upon in the group here as worthy of a letter to Nature, but this wasn't quite at that stage.
Well, I don't know. We made up for it later on. We soon got in the habit of letters to Nature. But, the other thing, I suppose, was that one was very dependent on presentation, and at that time, colour. And it was, you have the first of letters to Nature you have there, was a harmonic one.
Right.
You had to go to considerable subtlety to develop a good presentation.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this paper. When you first saw this, that must have been indeed quite exciting also.
Right. Well, actually, well, the history of that is that I think this is the first time the laboratory has ever published a paper in which one of the authors has been a technical assistant, and that was Bill Rowe. And it's since become a much more regular thing, but the reason was that he, through his own initiative, went down and recorded I think it was on a Sunday or something like that. And while he was there, he switched the equipment on, then went into Wollongong to do some shopping. And while he was in Wollongong, this event occurred.
I see.
And I think never was a case more deserving to have his name on the paper. And he described it to me at the time, and we could hardly wait for... we did our own processing on the spot. I might have done our own developing, I'm not sure. But I remember taking the film home. It was a very washed out sort of film on a very expanded timescale. It looked nothing like that, and it didn't go right after plotting it. But it was quite clear that there were two very distinct frequencies, and one had no idea what the relationship was between the two frequencies, really. And the excitement came when the 2-to-1 figure came, and I remember when I got it back at home in Sydney and did a crude measurement, and it kept on coming out for 2-to-1. That was a good moment.
But now what about when closer inspection showed that it was really 1.95?
I suppose it always has the immediate reaction is that one's disappointed that it's not something nice and simple. But when once you're convinced that it still has something to do to 2-to-1, it becomes much more interesting. And that's a very common thing, I think, that you like things, you hope everything's going to be terribly simple and straightforward. This is usually more interesting if it's not.
Right, but there's less information content.
Right. Right, so.
And so, did it take you long to come up with the reasoning that you did as to why it was not exactly 2-to-1?
I think that was a fairly immediate conclusion. At first, almost as a joke, and then. Realize that perhaps not much else it could be.
Now, just noticing here also that you only had this one case when you sent in the letter to Nature.
Right.
And then you have a note added in proof about a second one.
Right. But I think the thing is that it's one case which has so much information in it. Well, you only need one case in case that.
You had no fear about a birdie in your system? Or?
No fear whatsoever. A lot of my colleagues, including Bernie Mills, I think, were very suspicious of it. It was something to do with an instrumental effect. But we had one very great safeguard, and that the two harmonics, most of the time, were recorded on two entirely different receivers. And so. Because
yeah, that's definitely.
And cover 2-to-1 there.
And the fact that they were not exactly 2-to-1 again, was it?
Right. Yes. Even more so.
Argued. Yes. Yeah.
But it is. It still remains one of the. One couldn't ask for a better example to come along first. Many that have come along since. Much less impressive than that.
Mm-hmm. For my information, in our current understanding, is the explanation of this harmonics and the fact that it's not exactly 2-to-1, is that still the basic explanation that is accepted?
Yes, I think that really very little. That was extremely important at the time to establish or to make a case for the fact that they were harmonics. But I think very little work has been done on that since having once established that, or then it's just become accepted, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Let's move on to... this paper I wanted to ask you, if it's referring to you, a letter, an article with Krook.
Max Krook.
And it was just P. Wild, but it was you.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
At this time, you apparently were in America in 1956 at an AAS meeting.
Right.
And it was also a thing in Sky and Telescope about it. And here you are talking about shock waves in Type 2 and Type 3 bursts. So can you tell me?
I've completely forgotten that paper with Max Crook. I've forgotten what's in it.
Well, it was just an abstract.
Oh, I see.
So it never became a report of